This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 23, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Planned Parenthood rejects the plan of government agencies in two states attempting to seize private health records. The two-day Arab League summit wraps up in Algeria with debates over the Israeli peace process. And after spending 3 years in a British prison under emergency terror laws without charge or trial, 10 men still face severe restrictions on their freedoms. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Riot police broke up an opposition rally in the capital of Kyrgyzstan today, and the new interior minister warned that authorities may use force to restore order, suggesting that the government is seriously attempting to contain the protests in the southern portion of the country. Interior Minister Dushabayev says the law provides every right to take action, including the use of physical force, special means, and firearms. The new top police official spoke hours after President Akayev fired his predecessor and the chief prosecutor over unrest in the south, where opposition demonstrators have seized control of several key government buildings and pressured the president to resign over alleged vote fraud in recent parliamentary elections. Chile's defense minister Jaime Ravenet has denied that Chile sold weapons to Ecuador in 1995 as that country waged an undeclared border war with Peru. Jorge Garatón reports from Santiago.
Ravenet says Chile only sold small arms ammunition months before the conflict started. Former Ecuadorian Army General Victor Manuel Vallas, currently wanted in his country for arms trafficking, said yesterday that Chile had provided weapons to Ecuador after 1994. While the Peruvian government is demanding a thorough investigation, Chilean Defense Minister Ravenet says the matter is closed. Chile, along with Argentina, the U.S., and Brazil, are guarantors of a 1945 peace treaty signed by Peru and Ecuador following Peru's military expansion into Ecuador's Amazon region. Despite the assurances given by Ravenet, there is some concern among human rights lawyers in Santiago who feel a more thorough investigation should be undertaken. Lawyer Carmen Hurst says, at the time, the army was in the hands of former dictator Augusto Pinochet. She raises the speculation that some of Pinochet's recently discovered secret wealth may have come from illegal arms sales and does not rule out that he may have sold arms to Ecuador under the table. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta has denied a petition by the parents of Terry Schiavo to review a decision made earlier today by a three-judge panel. In that action, the court refused to issue an order to reinsert the feeding tube of the 41-year-old woman who has been in what doctors characterize as a persistent vegetative state for 14 years. Her feeding tube was removed 5 days ago under a state court order sought by her husband, Michael Schiavo. Florida Governor Jeb Bush held a press conference this afternoon during which he suggested that the State Department of Children and Families could invoke its right under Florida statute to provide protective services to certain, quote, vulnerable adults and apply it to the Terry Schiavo case. DCF Secretary Lucy Hattie says the department is considering all options, but specifically pointed to a provision that would allow the department to take a vulnerable person into its custody without prior judicial approval. The Florida Senate is currently debating a bill that would prohibit the denial of food and water to persons who had not expressed their wishes in writing. The outcome of that measure remains uncertain. A Guatemalan appeals court has knocked 10 years off the sentence of two military officers in a high-profile case for the murder of a bishop. Catherine Elton reports.
Nearly 4 years after an Army captain and his retired colonel father were convicted of murdering Roman Catholic Bishop Juan Girardi, an appeals court has dropped their conviction to accomplices and their sentences to 20 years. The sentence for the priest convicted as an accomplice wasn't changed. Girardi was bludgeoned to death in April 1998. 2 days earlier, he had released a report attributing the vast majority of the deaths and disappearances during Guatemala's armed conflict to military and paramilitary groups. The church's human rights office says even though the sentence was modified, the case is still groundbreaking. It is the first time in Guatemala that high-ranking military officers were convicted of a political crime. The defendants maintain their innocence and will take their case to the Supreme Court. For FSRN News, this is Catherine Elton in Guatemala City.
A federal judge extended a temporary restraining order, keeping the United States government from transferring detainees at Guantanamo Bay to other countries. Mitch Jezerich has the story.
For an additional 10 days, a district federal court has extended an injunction to bar the transfer of 13 detainees being held at Guantanamo Bay back to their home country of Yemen. Since the New York Times reported 2 weeks ago that the government is considering sending detainees to such countries as Yemen, Jordan, and Egypt, U.S. lawyers representing the so-called enemy combatants have been asking the courts to keep the government from doing so. Meg Satterthwaite with the Center for Human Rights and Global Justice worries that such prisoners are being sent to foreign countries where U.S. anti-torture laws don't apply.
It's fairly clear that it's illegal under U.S. law already. The Congress has implemented the Torture Convention, which clearly outlaws any kind of transfer to torture.
Democratic Representative Ed Markey of New York has introduced a measure to reinforce the prohibition of such practices known as extraordinary rendition. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
President Bush and his counterparts from Mexico and Canada met in Texas today to discuss North American security and economic issues. Efforts to develop a new trade pact between the three nations were linked to concerns stemming from 9/11. From KPFT in Houston, Renee Feltz reports.
President Bush's relations with Mexican President Vicente Fox and Canadian Prime Minister Paul Martin have been icy since neither country backed the U.S. invasion of Iraq. But today, the trio, dubbed by the media the Three Amigos, smiled for cameras and appeared cordial. The three issued a joint statement that while their nations have worked to enhance trade and have taken steps since the terrorist attacks of September 11th to address terrorism, more needs to be done. President Bush told reporters the issues of prosperity and security go hand in hand. Today, the leaders announced a new trade pact called Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America. The White House says the pact is meant to complement existing cooperative arrangements, such as the North American Free Trade Agreement, the Binational Commission of U.S. and Mexican Officials, and the Smart Border effort with Canada. Critics of NAFTA responded to the announcement with skepticism.
Clearly, this is a symbolic meeting designed not to solve concrete social and economic problems caused by actual trade rules of an actual trade agreement, NAFTA, but rather to reinvigorate the public's faltering commitment to the myth of free trade as the answer to all our problems.
Leslie Ramsey directs the Texas Fair Trade Coalition. The group held a press conference today at the Crawford Peace House. They wanted to confront claims by Presidents Bush and Fox about the successful impact of past economic alliances like NAFTA.
NAFTA is a failed model and has not lived up to the promises of its proponents. Any plan that takes NAFTA as a model as a positive starting point should be summarily rejected based on NAFTA's track record.
Today's announcement by the three leaders focused in part on developing new trade policies for energy imports. Labor journalist David Bacon responds.
There's no question that the U.S. wants to develop an arrangement with Mexico which would allow the U.S. to import energy from Mexico, electrical energy, that would essentially result in the building of electrical generation plants in Mexico that you might call electricity maquiladoras.
These new plants would allow electricity to be generated at a cheaper rate and then sent to the U.S. for consumption. Electricity production in Mexico is now controlled by the government. Efforts to privatize this production have met popular resistance. The issue of immigration also surfaced at today's summit. Groups like the National Alliance of Latin American and Caribbean Communities had hoped the summit would address immigration reform efforts now pending before the U.S. Congress. Houston-based Central American Resource Center spokeswoman Mayra Figorio held a press conference in Houston yesterday to highlight how current policies are tearing apart immigrant families.
And the other person who's from Mexico, she has been waiting 14 years for this visa to be approved. And this is due to the lack of new policies, new immigration reform. What happened is that our people is forced to come illegally to the country because of the waiting period.
Instead of this type of immigration reform, the three leaders focused on Bush's guest worker program, which is supported by President Fox. Fox has promised to open the border to workers who want to come to the U.S. Like the old Bracero program, this would not offer legal status to workers already in the U.S. or offer permanent residency to workers who travel to the U.S. Like most of the topics raised today, the immigration issue was linked to the issue of security. Again, David Bacon.
Those people who want vastly expanded new guest worker programs, namely large U.S. corporations, are trying to reframe their proposal in terms of national security.
Commitments made today are set to be accomplished through the creation of a ministerial-led group that will set measurable goals. A preliminary report from the ministers is due in 90 days. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
A two-day summit of Arab leaders concluded today in Algeria, which resulted in a decision to better market a 2002 peace plan for Israel by sending a committee to explain the plan to Europe, the United States, and other nations. The Arab League summit finished with Arab leaders and officials agreeing on the necessity of fostering peace between Arabs and Israelis, although some officials disagree on the correct formula. Ola Farawati has more.
The Arab League summit convened this year for the 17th time in Algeria has ended with a decision to put the peace initiative with Israel back on track and envisioning the formation of an Arab assembly. Arab countries agreed to form a three-member committee to compose a peace plan for Arabs to present to the world. Syrian President Bashar Assad.
I suggest that the committee also include Syria and Lebanon to have a better representation for the occupation-afflicted countries. This is how we can have a proper peace plan.
But Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak disagreed, saying that countries affected by the Israeli occupation should rather have other parties defending their rights. This triggered a give-and-take that made other Arab leaders suggest holding the conversation until after the session. Egyptian President Mubarak.
I suggest that other countries defend Syria and Lebanon and Jordan. The current members Sudan, Tunisia, and Algeria are enough, but maybe Jordan can join in.
The Arab League Secretary General Amr Moussa announced the Algerian declaration and said that Arab leaders have decided there is a need for reviving the peace plan in return for territory determined in Beirut in 2002. In the Beirut summit, Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah envisioned in a plan that relations between Arab countries and Israel could be normalized in return for recognition of a Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital and rights for refugees. But Israel rejected this plan. During a one-hour speech, Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi gave his take on Israeli-Palestinian relations.
I think that, sorry, but Israelis and Palestinians are stupid. They don't make peace with each other. I think that Sharon is an agent for the Palestinians, and I think young people in both countries shall, God willing, make peace.
Arab League Secretary General Amr Moussa has announced that the 22-member League has decided to form an Arab Assembly and the next summit would be held in the Sudanese capital, Al-Khartoum. In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Government agencies in two states have demanded that healthcare providers hand over the medical records of dozens of patients. Arguing that such demands are illegal and unconstitutional, Planned Parenthood is suing to block the state seizure of private records. Jenny Johnson reports.
Kansas Attorney General Phil Klein called the seizure of confidential medical records an inquisition. His office is seeking evidence of sexual abuse and other crimes through the medical records of women seeking reproductive health care. Citing flimsy and questionable reasons for the demands of two states for medical records, the president of Planned Parenthood of Kansas, Peter Brownlee, characterized the inquiries as political.
It's simply wrong to expect any doctor to turn over medical records of dozens of patients based on the hunch, or I suspect in this case, the hope of the Attorney General that he might find evidence of crimes. The Attorney General's actions are quite simply part of a radical political agenda to take away women's rights to make their own decisions for their lives and to destroy their right to reproductive health care.
the clear anti-abortion stances of both the attorneys general of Indiana and Kansas raises the specter that these cases may be politically motivated rather than motivated by an investigation of child abuse. In Kansas, attorneys called into question which files the state is seeking to access. Planned Parenthood attorney Roger Evans explains.
This investigation is all about protecting minors, all about child rape and horrible things like that. Of the records subpoenaed from Planned Parenthood, less than 10% are records of minors who are in the age range of where they could be victims of child abuse under Kansas law or victims of rape under Kansas law. Less than 10%. The vast majority of the records are of adult women.
Illegal late-term abortions are also being targeted for investigation. Phil Klein, Kansas Attorney General, says that he wanted to keep the subpoena of records confidential, but Planned Parenthood made it public. The other centerpiece of the fight in Kansas is the state's demand for completely unedited original records. Again, Roger Evans.
And we are asking the state Supreme Court to allow us to produce information relevant to whatever crime may be investigated, but that we should not be required to produce patient identifying information and all of the other information that is in those files that is entirely irrelevant to any criminal investigation.
Dr. Vanessa Collins of Planned Parenthood took issue with the potential for decreased patient confidentiality.
I ask you how we in this country can reach the underserved if government takes the liberty to strong-arm medical staff and medical organizations to turn over entire medical records for undefined or bogus reasons.
Karen Pearl, interim president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, explains the situation in Indiana.
Earlier this month, an agent of the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit of the Office of the Indiana Attorney General entered three health centers run by Planned Parenthood of Indiana and demanded medical records of specific minors under the age of 14 who had come to receive services other than abortion.
The staff initially handed over the records but is now seeking explanation, citing implausible rationale for investigation. Emily Stewart addresses the overall threat Planned Parenthood believes state intervention means to women seeking reproductive health care.
It's so important to protect patients because if they think that their information is going to be disclosed or they think that they're private, there's a potential for a violation, they're going to withdraw from care. And if these providers weren't fighting these demands, that's exactly what would happen.
By airtime, both of the attorneys general offices were unavailable for comment. Currently, both of these cases are pending in the state courts. Jenny Johnson, Free Speech Radio News.
Thousands of bank employees took to the streets in India on strike yesterday. Today, public sector insurance employees were also on strike. This is the employees of the government-owned telephone company continued their week-long strike as well. All of them are protesting the government's move towards promoting mergers and acquisitions. These workers fear recent moves by the government is a gift, giving away profit-making public sector companies to multinational corporations. Vinod K. Jose has the details of the strike from New Delhi.
Main traffic intersections in all the towns in the country witness strong protests from thousands of employees working in the public banking industry. The strike was called by the United Forum of Bank Unions, representing 9 organizations of employees and officers. Nearly 1 million employees went on strike. T.N. Goyal is the president of All India Bank Officers Confederation.
Our apprehension right since 1991 has been that the government is acting under the influence of certain Western authorities like the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO. The new economic policies that were initiated around that time were also dictated by these agencies. And our apprehension is that there is a game plan. There is a game plan of the multinationals to take over the lucrative financial sector of this country.
India has 27 nationalized banks and hundreds of cooperative banks. Once, when India claimed to be a socialist country, public banks were considered to be the temple of growth. Now the government wants to reduce the number of government-owned banks through acquisitions and mergers. This will result in the closure of 22,000 branches nationwide. Ashok Rao is the Secretary General of the Employees of the State-Owned Companies.
You know, banking is not just about your putting your money into a bank and withdrawing it when you want. It is also about mobilizing credit and distributing credit. And credit distribution is not democratic. The reason some companies are so large are because they have access to credit. And also another important question is who owns the banking assets? And if your banking assets are owned by foreigners, then what really can you do with the credit policy and other important fiscal policies?
There were instances of the big transnational companies in India taking away loans from the public banks and never paying back. The workers allege credit is always available for the big industrial houses and never for a subsistence farmer or to a poor citizen. They fear foreign direct investments and handing over the government-controlled banks to private companies will only help to widen the gap of haves and have-nots. From New Delhi in India, I am Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
A British foreign national who was held under the country's now expired anti-terror laws for over 3 years has attempted to commit suicide. Mahmoud Suleiman Ahmed Abu Rida was admitted to a London hospital after a drug overdose. He was also treated for an infection from the electronic ankle tag he's forced to wear. At least two other prisoners have faced severe psychiatric difficulties since their release from Belmarsh Prison, nicknamed Britain's Guantanamo. The British government has released 10 foreign nationals they've been holding indefinitely without charge or trial under emergency terrorism laws, although the men continue to live under severe surveillance and restrictions on their movement and communication. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
The British government was forced into releasing the men after the High Court ruled that detaining people indefinitely without charge or trial was unlawful. But they're far from free men. The Prevention of Terrorism Act 2005 has placed them under house arrest, once again without charge or trial. Similar to the control orders that were placed on anti-apartheid activists in South Africa, the men are prohibited from possessing certain items and from specified activities, from using mobile phones or the internet, and from association with specified persons or with other persons generally. They must comply to their movements being monitored, being tagged, their homes being searched at any time, and must allow access to their homes to specified persons. Lawyer Natalie Garcia describes the problems experienced by her client on his release.
He'd been released with no money and no food at all. He'd been taken to his accommodation address, no food there and an empty fridge. He couldn't make any telephone calls out, so he couldn't seek assistance to get food, and even if there had been a line for him to ring out from, nobody would have been able to bring him food because nobody is allowed to come to his house unless they've been previously cleared by the Home Office to do so.
Lawyer Gareth Pearce describes the uncertainty about the control order faced by her clients.
There's a profound unease at the vagueness and lack of definition here. A man, for instance, this weekend is worried if he goes outside and puts his dustbin out, is genuinely worried that he's in breach of his order. But I think more seriously, the same man is even more worried that he was locked up 3 years ago on evidence he didn't know and still hasn't been told. He's never been spoken to by any police, any intelligence services. And if he goes out now, as he's permitted to do 12 hours in the day, he doesn't know who he's allowed to speak to, who he isn't, what he's allowed to do or not do that will cross another line that might lead to him being detained.
Lord Toby Harris of the Metropolitan Police Authority.
I think the reality is going to be that this will be quite difficult to monitor, quite difficult to keep under control, and I'm sure the public will be concerned despite the best efforts that will no doubt be made to do this confidentially. The fact is there will have been a big flurry around the addresses where these people are going as surveillance arrangements are put in place, as the individuals are returned. I wouldn't be at all surprised to discover that there are journalists, for all I know, TV and radio crews outside some of the addresses. That's going to attract a great deal of attention from neighbours. I suspect that with the best will in the world, the anonymity of some of these individuals will have been severely disrupted.
Politicians, lawyers, police and judges have expressed their concern at the Home Secretary's new powers to put people under house arrest. Labour MP John McDonnell fought against the new terrorism legislation.
What we have to guard against is the slow erosion of civil liberties and democratic practices by a form of conservative authoritarianism. And what we found under this Labour government is that slow creeping erosion of basic civil liberties and some basic human rights as well. What we're having to do is resort to the courts, European law and demonstrations to reassert those democratic rights that we thought were fought for, campaigned for and won for all time but are now being eroded. And my fear now is that we live in quite a conservative authoritarian state, almost on the American model.
The irony is, say lawyers, that just as the British government was found to be acting unlawfully in imprisoning these men without charge or trial, house arrest is no more lawful. Justice, they say, means a fair trial, and they'll appeal once again to the High Court. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
2 years ago, Cuban authorities arrested, tried, and sentenced 75 people accused of receiving money from Washington-sponsored organizations to destabilize the Cuban government. The international press decried what it termed human rights abuses against the dissidents, while local residents have mixed feelings about the prisoners. In Cuba, Joseph Muti has more.
Most people in Cuba have no problem with the arrests, as the 75 were undeniably receiving both money and goods from the USA. However, many feel the punishment of an average of 20 years in prison was overly excessive, although it should be noted that 14 of them have already been released for health reasons. Alfonso Hernandez is a computer technician who supports the right to disagree with government policy, but certainly not for payment.
They have another view of things here, and they just express what they felt. It's not right to receive money. If it's from the government of a hostile country, yeah, I think it's wrong.
As to the suggestion by some that the 75 be simply shipped off to Miami to enjoy the society they so openly espouse, Alfonso was adamant that that was morally reprehensible.
They are Cubans, they have the right to be here. If they want to stay here and have a different opinion or view of things, they have that right.
Nancy Kolejczyk, a U.S. journalist who specializes in Cuba, agreed that the sentences were excessive, but understands the Cuban reaction behind the arrests 2 years ago.
I do feel like the sentences were much too long, but I do think that in the short run, the issue was that because that they've been demonstrated to be clearly linked to the U.S. government through the U.S. interest section, that they were an immediate concrete military threat to Cuba during the days in which they were arrested. And many dissident leaders that were more influential and more public and more significantly could be seen as a sort of quote-unquote political threat to the Cuban government were not arrested. But the people who were arrested were the ones that were proven to have concrete ties to the U.S. government.
Aside from this, Nancy also commented on the complete lack of following that those who were imprisoned 2 years ago command.
I also think it's important when talking about these quote-unquote dissidents in Cuba to recognize that they don't have massive support among the Cuban people. Yes, people here have needs and dreams and desires that are not all being met, but the needs and dreams and desires are very heterogeneous. The fact that the dissident groups don't speak to people's hopes and dreams, I think, is very significant.
Cubans question the double standard of the international mainstream press that seeks to condemn Cuba for supposed human rights violations while largely ignoring atrocious human rights violations elsewhere in the world, including within the United States of America. In Havana, for Free Speech Radio, I'm Joseph Muti.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.